Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain, our opportunity to step into the world of theater and the arts, often for what is going on in the Chicagoland area. But sometimes we're lucky enough to have somebody join us who's just a stellar star in the world of theater who will spend a little time with us. You're going to meet that person today because this woman has written so many shows. You're going to go, really? 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 Yes. Let me introduce you to Sandy Rustin. She is a book writer, a playwright, an actor, a voiceover artist. And Sandy, it's fair enough to say because it's WGN, you're one of Chicago's very own.
I am. Yes, I grew up in Chicago. Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I have to ask, because, you know, this is, we always, when somebody was born and raised here, where exactly did you grow up?
So I grew up in Glenview.
Okay.
I went to New Trier High School.
And you ate at Hackney's.
Yes, exactly. And then I went to Northwestern.
I love it. But now you're in New York because you're doing all this famous stuff, although you could do it in Chicago, but that's up to you.
Hey, did my mother put you up to this?
Yeah, she did. She's right here.
Oh, yeah.
So what brought me to you initially is because you have written the book for a show that was just gangbusters over at Marriott Lincolnshire Theater called Always Something There. It's an 80s jukebox musical. But the thing is, we'll talk about these things, but you are responsible for the play Clue, which has had like 4,000 productions all over the world. It seems to be in Chicago every other month with somebody putting it on. And Mystic Pizza. And just all of these classic things. And it's like when I started looking, I'm like, it's all you. It's all Sandy. So let me just take a step back. And because you're also an actor and other things, what is it that draws you to a project? Since it's most recently here, Always Something There, an 80s jukebox musical, why did you say, I'm going to work on this after
Sure.
all the things you've done?
Well, Always Something There, for a long time, I have had an idea about doing this kind of a high school musical. I had played Sandy in the National Tour of Greece, was my first job out of school. And as I grew up a little bit more and became a parent myself, I began to carry a little bit of guilt about playing Sandy in Greece, because the message at the end of that show is that the girl has to sort of change herself to get the guy. And as I was becoming a writer myself, I thought, I wonder if I could create a show in the same vein as Grease, something fun and high school oriented that has the same sensibility that Grease has, but that feels like it has a more contemporary message for young women. And that was really the impetus behind the process of starting to write Always Something There.
And let's talk a little bit about sort of what the show is about. You know, I mean, folks who have seen it at Marriott, of course, obviously will know about it. But this is a little different because when you say Grease, people are now thinking of a Grease kind of plot. But no, you don't do that. This is time travel, I think.
Yes. Yes. So this show, yes, it is a high school show, but it is intended to be an homage to the John Hughes movies of my youth, because that was where I grew up, you know, Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles. These are the movies that I grew up with. And I wanted to take a look at those movies and just teen flicks of that era. So Back to the Future, Peggy Sue Got Married, there's little Easter eggs throughout the entire show, little tip of the hat to all those films. And so I thought, well, what if I did sort of a Back to the Future, Peggy Sue Got Married kind of a story with a contemporary feminist twist to it?
Yeah.
So Always Something There is about a woman on her 45th birthday who's sort of at rock bottom. She gets a little drunk. She makes a wish on a birthday candle. And when she wakes up in her 18-year-old body in her senior year of high school. And she has an opportunity to redo all these sorts of choices and decisions throughout her high school career to wind up living the kind of life that she had always dreamed of.
And
so
I won't give
second
anything.
Chance
I think
kind of musical.
We should always sort of save secrets. I think you can divulge what you want. But, you know, as you're sitting there, certainly when act two comes along, the first thing you're wondering is, OK, is this a dream? Is it real? And I will say this. You answered the question at the end of the show.
Well, good. I'm glad you feel that way.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't? Do I have to go have conversations with people now? We decided that you did. So when you select the music, did you sort of start, you have the story, did you say, now what songs from the 80s will work? Because I walked out, as I'm with my partner, whatever, we're talking about all the songs that you use, which I didn't grow up in the 80s, but close enough. You know, then you start thinking of, okay, this song wasn't in the show. So, you know, did you struggle with that?
Well, when I had this idea during the pandemic, I shared it with a producer who was working with Primary Wave Music and their music catalog. And they were looking for somebody to create a show that utilized music from their catalog. So it was actually really helpful because I had parameters. You know, I wanted top 10 hits from the 80s in the US and or the UK that were also mostly from the Primary Wave Music catalog. So I had a place to begin, and I wrote the show as if I would just write a play with no music and figured out where would music organically come. And then once I could figure out where I thought the show was supposed to sing, which moments, you know, could heighten to musicality. Then I went to the Primary Wave Music catalog and looked through their songs and tried to find songs that would fit each specific moment to help advance the plot, to help, you know, carry out the arcs of these characters and things like that.
So did you change plot points in order to go, oh, I really want to do this song, so I think I'm gonna have to modify this.
I didn't. I really tried to hold true to the story I wanted to tell and find songs that fit the bill.
I will say, at least for the Marriott production, you cast as one of the leads, adult Samantha, Heidi Kettering, who is just a treasure of Chicago theater here. And then I
Yes.
come to learn that, well, I guess part of the reason you did that is why?
We went to college together.
Yeah.
Heidi was, I believe Heidi was a senior when I was a freshman, so I admired her
She will not
enormously.
appreciate you saying that, but go ahead.
No, she'd be okay with it. I
Okay.
looked up to her. We were in the same sorority very briefly. Yeah, I just have always admired her so much, and I know that she is just the queen of Chicago theater. And so when I knew the show was coming to Chicago, I said, how about Heidi Kettering? And of course, the Marriott Lincolnshire adores her. So it was not a difficult choice to place.
And why? I mean, I get all the reasons you might put it here because you mentioned Grease, Jim Jacobs, of course, also Chicago boy who wrote that here. But you know, you could have started it off Broadway. You could have taken it elsewhere. Was this because this is home and this is a gift back to your community?
Well, it's a couple things. This is the premiere production. So this show has not yet had, this is the first opportunity we've had to see it up on its feet and to see it spring to life. So very typically before a show would open in New York, you do what's called an out-of-town tryout. And it just so happened that the Marriott Lincolnshire hadn't done a world premiere in quite some time. They were looking to do a world premiere this year, and they had a relationship with James Vasquez, who's our director, and said, what do you have? Do you have something that might fit the bill for us? And James introduced them to this show, and they said, great, we're going to do that. So it was just sort of kismet. It worked out.
And perfect too, right? I mean, because this is coming home.
Yeah, I
And
think so.
so I'm sure your family, I'm sure everybody is incredibly proud to watch this. So by the way,
Thank you.
so now that it's played here, and I'm guessing the thought is that it will now move on somewhere, maybe Broadway, we'll see what happens. But as a result, you say, now I have changes to make? You go, no, the show is the show and we'll see who else wants to do it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, from your lips, thank you very much, Paul. Of course, every opportunity that I have to put a show up on its feet and re-explore it is an opportunity to make changes and improve it and, you know, further connect with the audiences. And of course, the Marriott Lincolnshire is a unique opportunity because it's in the round. So you're structuring a whole show, all the staging, the choreography, everything is focused on, you know, people being able to see it on all four sides, whereas most theaters in the country are proscenium theaters. And so I imagine that our next opportunity to do the show will be in a place where we'll have a chance to see, oh yeah, we could have a trap door. We could, you know, we could have things come in from above. We can, you know, use the wings in a more traditional way. Things that we didn't have an opportunity to do at the Marriott, which was wonderful because it forced us to become really creative as to how to tell this story without those tools. So I think the next step will be to figure out how to tell the story with those tools.
Yeah, Marriott gets it so well, the how you get on stage and off stage and the props flying in and out and everybody. What I also love is the characters in this show, we all relate to that. So you and I went to high school at different times, but we had those. We had, you know, the rock star guy, the, you know, all those people who thought they were going to become the next Rolling Stones or whatever. One of my favorite characters in the show is the character of Winston, who is that nerd guy who, you know, that decades later has just created the latest tech company of somehow. And you actually think that too from the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really tried to pepper in all those classic characters from the 80s movies that we, you know, the tropes of characters, and then flesh them out and turn them into more real people, you know, with real dreams.
So Just amazing. Congratulations on it. And I'm so
Thanks.
glad that, thank you. People like Jerry Mitchell would say, yes, I agree. Chicago is the place you want to go to try out your shows before you go anywhere, as he did with Kinky Boots and Boop and almost everything Jerry does. Because Chicago, well, by the way, your shows have been in everywhere, Broadway and everywhere. So what did you think of Chicago audiences as you experienced? I think we're a pretty good, sophisticated audience here.
Absolutely. I mean, Chicago is forever home for me. So, to have my shows be produced and performed in Chicago is always my favorite. And this was absolutely no exception. And it was particularly fun. This is the first time I've had a premiere in Chicago. And so, it was all the people I've grown up with, the people I went through the 80s with, my parents, friends, our neighbors, it felt very wonderful to be home and to have the show supported in such a wonderful familial way.
Exactly, a memory of a lifetime. So
Yes.
that was an important moment in your career, always something there, which the Marriott was honored, I would say, to be able to put up first before we see it around the country. Did you get what you needed out of this out of town, we'll call it out of town because you live in New York,
Yeah.
tryout?
Oh,
Wish you had more
absolutely.
time or what?
Oh, I mean, sure. Who doesn't want wish that they had more time whenever you're, making anything creative? But this was a dream experience. It was an incredible rehearsal process. The cast is dreamy. Everybody at the theater was really, really wonderful. The audience has absolutely embraced the show. So, we got everything we wanted and more out of this experience.
So we have two Sams. There's the adult Sam. I'm going to say older Sam. Heidi would kill
Yep.
me. So we have adult Sam, played by Heidi Kettering, your old classmate, as we talked about, though clearly she's older. But we also talk about young Sam, who's played by Christina Priestner. Wow, her, I mean, I don't know how she does that one 8 times a week. The
Isn't she
power that.
awesome? She's so wonderful. Yeah. Christina is I met Christina when I was working on Mystic Pizza in New Jersey, actually. She was at the pilot high school that did the pilot program, the pilot production of Mystic Pizza. And so she reached out and sent an email and invited me to come see the show. And yeah, and so then she sort of was on my radar. So when we were creating Always Something There, and I knew we needed a really strong female lead in this teenage role. She was a local teenager who I knew she could sing it. And I was like, how about this girl? And so she came on a few years ago as we started to develop the show, and she's been a part of it ever since. She's
How
wonderful.
involved were you with the overall casting? Because I mean, the casting is brilliant. There's the rock star guy, there's the nerd guy, there's the bully guy, all of these sort of classic types. Were you involved in the casting, or did the Marriott and the director handle all of that?
The Marriott and the director and the choreographer handled the casting. Sometimes I'm involved with casting and sometimes I'm not. In this situation, I was out of town and I was working on some other things. So, when the director and choreographer and the Marriott felt like they knew who they wanted to hire, sometimes they would send me like, "Hey, this is our top pick. Is this okay with you?" kind of a thing. And obviously they did a phenomenal job and the cast is absolutely terrific.
How do you feel when you're watching? We could say this for any of your shows, Clue and Mystic Pizza, whatever, but we're talking about Always Something There. How do you feel as the person who wrote the book, sitting there watching this prefer? Are you nervous? Are you a mom watching their child? What are the emotions?
Well, it depends on the night. Obviously, like that first performance is full of jitters. But then, of course, with the first laugh, with the first applause, I relax and I think, oh, everybody seems to be having a great time. And that relaxes me. I think the thing that I feel the most when I'm sitting in the audience of any of my shows is this sense of gratitude that not only did somebody say, like, hey, we think that this is worth putting on the stage, but it has then this idea, this initial germ of something has inspired all these people's jobs. There's a hundred of people that are working on a show at any given moment, and all these people are putting their time, their talent, their energy into it. And it leaves me feeling incredibly grateful. So that's usually how I feel in the audience is like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
By the way, because you sing, you perform. If for some reason on opening night, Heidi went, I don't feel like doing this tonight. Could you have gotten, because you're basically the same age. Could you have said, I gotcha, and have done it?
Well, there's a difference between could I have done it and should I have done it, right? So Heidi has an amazing understudy and we're good to go. So
I was just
that
trying to get you're sitting there, you're watching it, like you're like, I want to do this, or like, nah.
You know what? I sort of have committed to not doing 8 shows a week until my kids have both graduated high school. But in a couple of years, I might revisit performing, and that would feel great at that time. But until then, I'm really happy to be the writer and sit in the audience.
All right. And by the way, if you do go back to performing in the future, I'm sure you will one day, would you like to perform in one of your own shows, or would you go, no, I wouldn't want to do that?
Yeah, I think if I go back to performing one day, that I would definitely like to be in my own shows. I think that would
Okay.
be really fun.
Let me ask you, we did always something there because I don't know where to, I don't give away things. I always tell this story when I interviewed the cast of Dear Evan Hansen. I asked up front, is there anything you don't want me to bring up? And one of them said, don't say that Connor is dead. And I'm like, he dies in the first 2 seconds of the play. What, how we, so, but I'm always cautious about that. And when I recently did a show, You Will Get Sick at Steppenwolf, we had Amy Morton and all sorts of great things. I asked Amy to give the plot of the play because I didn't know what to say. She said about 2 sentences and she goes, that's all I'm saying. So this question, we talked earlier about the fact that I think you resolve this question. Heidi seemingly goes back in time to her high school self, and we watch things underplay. And I told you during the TD portion, I felt you resolved whether that was a dream or real or whatever at the end. And you said you go ahead and believe what you want. So I just have to follow up now in
What
our bonus.
did you think the resolution was?
You want me to tell you?
Sure.
I thought it was real. I didn't think it was a dream because of again, I'll try not to give things away, because of the kids who come in to talk to her, because of a husband who shows up to talk to her at the end. So it would say to me that somehow it either all changed, or maybe she wasn't, I don't know, maybe she didn't live the life we all thought she was living at the beginning. Maybe that's the trick. What are you doing to us?
I have nothing to say on the matter. I'm so glad that you have a definitive answer about how this play resolves. That's wonderful. And
Okay, then, all right, then let me word it this way. Do
yeah.
you have, you don't tell me what it is, do you have a definitive answer in your mind? Do you know how it ends?
I think that for me, that I have ended this play deliberately, in such a way that each audience member can make their own choice about what they think happens at the end.
The fact that I'm so definitive, you're going, poor boy, what is your problem? Because
No,
you're.
not at all. It delights me. It makes me so happy that you have your satisfying ending. I hope every audience member has a satisfying ending, even if they're not the same.
Oh, by the way, if it was not a satisfied ending, if I would have said to you, I'm very frustrated, Sandy, and here's a variety of reasons. As a playwright, it's sort of like the last moment of The Sopranos, right? The lights go out, and David Chase, who has never told us, I don't think, what it is that really happened, everybody, all heck broke loose when that happens. But if I had said to you, I'm very frustrated, I don't know the ending, would that bother you as a playwright? Or you'd be like, I don't care, it's your problem.
Oh no, I think neither. I don't think it would bother me, and I don't think that I would dismiss it. I think I would take that to heart. I mean, I tend to listen to audience feedback way more than any other kind of feedback. So if I'm getting a lot of feedback in the same lane from a bunch of different audience members, I know that I have something that I need to pay attention to there. I will tell you though about endings. When I was writing Clue, when I started to write Clue, I had a meeting with Jonathan Lynn, who wrote the screenplay. He was really generous and was basically like, do what you want with it. But when I was writing the movie, the studio forced me to create a multi-ending, and I really didn't like it. So please don't do
Oh.
the multi-ending. And I said, okay, no problem. And then I had a meeting with the people at the movie studio, and they were really generous and kind and said, do what you want with it, whatever you want. The only thing that we really insist upon is a multi-ending. And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I gonna do? And so creating the ending of Clue in such a way that could satisfy both of those requests, plus the audience, plus myself, that was a huge challenge. So you'll have to, next time you see Clue, you'll have to pay attention to that, and then you can let me know what you think.
Yeah, I guess so. And there are shows like Sheer Madness, whatever, where I mean the audience does get involved. That ran here
Sure.
forever, so you probably remember it. But
Yeah.
where we kind of pick how we want things to end. Would you like to write a play where the audience is voting?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I'm not opposed to it. That's definitely more of like an interactive theater experience, which I haven't written yet. So I'm not going to say no to it, but that's not my go-to thing.
Okay. And by the way, when I know your family's here, so they came to the show. So afterwards, did you have this conversation with them? Did they also want to talk about how this show ends? And were you being as vague as you are with me? Or did you say,
No,
all right,
actually,
mom, I'm going to tell you the truth?
no. I did. Nobody brought it up. So I don't
Oh,
know.
really?
Maybe they all just thought it ends the way that they wanted it to end.
Okay.
I'll have
I
to ask
also am
them.
going to suspect that probably cast members might be watching us. I would be if I was in the show. So let's be a dream crusher. or maybe a dream maker. So when I'm an optimist, when the show goes on to wherever it goes next, wherever it be, will you think about these current cast members and potentially invite them along? Or will you say, nah, if we put it up at Paper Mill or it goes somewhere else, it's just a new director, a new whatever has to take care of its own cast
Oh,
members.
always, always. I mean, I love actors so much, and I feel always indebted to the heart and soul that actors put into a show, especially in a world premiere, because they bring so much of themselves to it, and it allows us to shape a show around the people who have originated these roles. So, for sure, these actors will always hold a special place in my heart and a special place in this show. As the writer, I don't always have control over casting, and we just move forward into the world with the piece of theater, and people get very busy. People have other jobs and other shows, and so you never really know how that's going to
Yeah.
shake out. But I will be forever grateful and love this cast so much, and certainly hope that I get to work with all of them again
I
in the
guess
future.
one last thing I did want to ask you, when you're doing something which was a movie first, be it Clue, be it Mystic Pizza, I just recently talked to Amy Morton recently, where she stepped into in the show she was doing a role Linda Lavin played on Broadway. So I talked about the impact of how does that affect you? I mean, when somebody defines a role, Angela Lansbury or Linda Lavin or these great people, how does that affect you as a performer going forward? Were you influenced by any of the actors you saw when a movie version preceded what you were doing?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you can't help it, right? Like they embody that character and they give it a certain essence, and as the writer, you're absorbing a lot of information when you're doing an adaptation. So you're absorbing what's on the page, what the writer intended just in words, but then you're also absorbing how the director funneled that into a vision, and the designers and the costumes and the actors themselves and how lines were delivered and tone and style and all of those things. So I would say all of those things come together as into like one pot of information. And then as the writer, adapting it into something unique and fresh that will give an audience a new experience while also feeling nostalgic and reminiscent of the original material. Your job is to sort of, mix it all up into a giant cocktail and spew out something new. But of course, all of those things are influential.
I think when you do do shows like Always Something There, do we call you playwright or do we call you book writer?
Yeah, either they're synonymous. I think people use the term book writer for musicals because it implies the person who's writing the script as opposed to the person who's writing the music. So
Okay.
either way it goes.
So, and by the way, as we talk about your various parts of careers, are you an actor who happens to write plays and do other things? Or are you a playwright who used to act?
Yeah, so I grew up with the dual focus in performance and playwriting. From the time I was little, I wanted to do both things. Nutcher High School famously had Lagniappe Potpourri, which was a student-written musical. So I was in it as a performer, but also on the writing team, and eventually got to write it my senior year. Same deal at Northwestern. Northwestern has WAMU, which is a huge student-written musical. I would perform in it as a performer, but also be part of the writing team. Studied in London, had a dual focus in performance and playwriting. And when I moved to New York, I was working pretty steadily as an actor. So I sort of set my playwriting brain aside for a few years. And when I became a parent, that 8 show a week schedule as a performer was a lot. And so I found for me, the schedule of being a playwright was much more conducive to parenting, for me in my life. So that was sort of when I shifted focus, but I keep both hats on, and you never know. I like to do both.
Yeah, and I guess it would be tough to start going on national tours. I mean, your past included I Love You, You're Perfect Now, Change, which is played here not all that long ago over at the North Shore Center for Performing Arts. But you've done TV, Inside Amy Schumer, Law and Order, All My Children. I mean, you've dabbled within everything. Is there, in the acting portion, a favorite genre for you?
No, I just like telling great stories and playing great roles. I wouldn't say that there's any one particular genre or style that calls to me. I
Okay.
like, yeah, I, you know, whatever comes my way, I evaluate it for what it is.
I love it. And of course, while you were doing All My Children, probably across the way filming was Chicago's own Nancy Grant, who we grew up together in Skokie, who was in General Hospital for a million years, and doing all of those. So what a life that brings. Let me take you back to, well, I do want to mention voiceover real quickly because we hear your voice on various things too.
Yeah, that's right. So, many years ago, like almost 25 years ago, I met, so I was working with another actor in New York. We were both understudies, so we spent a lot of time together backstage. He's a wonderful actor named Bruce Wynant. And Bruce began a company in New York of doing post-production additional dialogue recording for television and film. And he invited me into his circle of actors to work with him. And so I started doing that probably in 2001, I think. And I've worked with Bruce and his company for all these many years doing voiceover work for television and film. And it's I love it. It's a wonderful sort of section of my career and my life. And it affords our family our health insurance through the Screen Actors Guild. And it's been a great resource for us.
Yeah, I got that same insurance. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have to say, I studied voiceover work here with a woman named Sherry Berger, who was very well known in the Chicago area for that work. You know, people think it's, I thought it was easy. Give me the script. And she would like, I'd have to say one word like chocolate or something like that. And she would spend 45 minutes trying to show me that I couldn't say the word chocolate right. And I'm like, I'm not hearing this.
Yeah, it's an art.
Man. So congratulations on getting that, and maybe you can teach me a few tricks. I just can't get it down. Anyway, let's talk about the playwriting world. And I'm immediately drawn to two things, as you would guess. First of all, Clue, as I said, produced 4,000 productions, but in fairness, it did begin as a movie. You didn't write the movie.
Correct. Yeah. So Clue is a household name, right? Everybody's played the board game. In the 80s, the movie Clue came out and it became sort of this like cult hit film. It wasn't immediately well received, but over time it became this thing that people really grew to love. And so some commercial producers acquired the rights to the board game and to the film and then put together a creative team to create a stage adaptation of that movie. And that's how I got involved in creating that show. And we opened that show in January of 2020 at the Cleveland Playhouse, and it was great. It was so much fun.
Except that date sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah. And then the world shut down. And so what happened was is the licensing company created an at-home version for people to do theaters, schools, whoever, they could do the play over Zoom. And so throughout the pandemic, people were doing that. So when the pandemic lifted and people were able to go back to doing live theater again, there was really an audience built up from these at-home versions. And suddenly all these places across the country began to do live productions of it. And it took off from there. And then we had an opportunity, our specific creative team had an opportunity to do it in Los Angeles, here in New York at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey. And then from there, we launched a national tour that was just running for the last 18 months that, and then we're on a little summer hiatus and we're going to relaunch a tour again in
Oh,
October.
it's fab. And it's been done here in Chicago so many times, even of recent note. And it's just so, did you have freedom in writing that? You know, who's going to do it, whatever? Or is a lot of that dictated either by the movie or, I mean, not really by the game, because it could go in different directions.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it is intended to be an adaptation of the film. So I inherited those characters, the plot, all those things. But then there was freedom to deepen those characters, to find our own plot, to figure out how it was going to move on stage. I had a wonderful collaboration with Lee Savage, who is our set designer for our productions in the national tour that's directed by my very good friend and collaborator, Casey Hushin. And Lee came up with this amazing idea of this like Swiss Army knife concept for the set. And once I really understood how the set could function in the way that the set functions in the film, but on stage, that's when I was really able to start to write the show and understand how it would move in the theater.
And how important are connections? And by that, I mean, I'm talking about your show, The Cottage. You know, I'm thinking if I'm doing The Cottage, yeah, get me Jason Alexander. I'm going to have him direct this thing. And by the way, I think we'll cast Eric McCormick and Laura Bell Bundy in this show. I mean, are these people you're like, yeah, I know all of them. So we get them together. I mean, talk about the magic of making that happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. The Cottage was a play I wrote 10 years before it premiered on Broadway. And it had been kicking around all these regional theaters around the country and doing fairly well and, you know, have and nicely received and good reviews and all of these things. And simultaneously to that, Jason was looking to make his Broadway debut as a director. And at the time, we were at the same agency. And so he said, you know, what plays do you have that are ready to come to Broadway? And they shared a bunch of shows with him and he gravitated to this one and we met and then he decided he would attach himself to this. And then when we were looking to hire the character of Beau, Jason is personally friends with Eric, and so he reached out, shared the script, and Eric said, "Yeah, this sounds like a lot of fun." Laura, I had never met, though I admired her enormously as a performer, and she also was at an agency. We shared the same agency, and so when we knew that the show was coming to Broadway, I said, "Well, what could we get this script to Laura Bell Bundy?" And the rest was history.
With all respect to your tremendous talent and all that, I'm not taking anything away from that, but it sounds like in your, do you have these pinch me moments from time to
Oh
time?
my gosh, every day, anytime anybody wants to produce my work, I feel so, just flooded with gratitude. It's amazing.
Yeah,
Yes.
I produce some shows. I've lost in every single one of them. So maybe I've been with the, I need to work with you because Broadway Bubbies did not make me a lot of money here in Chicago. I can tell you that.
Oh, Broadway Bubbies is a great title, though.
Yeah, wasn't it a great title? And it started
Oh,
Edie
that's so fun.
Adams, and yeah, it should have done. I lost everything. Anyway, Mystic Pizza. Again, people are like, their mind goes to the movie, I think. So movie comes first, and then once again, you get involved and say, time to be a play.
Exactly. So Mystic Pizza again was commercial producers acquired the rights to the film and then sought out a creative team. And actually, that is another collaboration between me and Casey Hushen, my friend and director, who's a collaborator of mine. And yeah, they came to us and said, "What do you think? Do you think you could turn this movie into a stage play and specifically into a musical?" And so that's what we did.
I love it. You've written a play called The Suffragettes Murder, which premiered in Denver.
Yes.
Nothing to do with Suffs, the musical on Broadway.
No, it was
Okay.
just, yeah, that the Suffragettes Murder. I am a playwright in residence at the Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And during the pandemic, they commissioned four US playwrights to write any play of their choosing on the subject of women's suffrage because it was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of women's suffrage in America. And I said, "Can I write a comedy?" And they said, "Yes." And so I wrote that play, and it then went to the New Plays Festival at Denver Center for Performing Arts and got selected there to have its world premiere
It's like
just
everything, it's
months
amazing.
ago.
And one day you wake up and go, I think I want to work with Disney. And so we get Jolly Holiday and Disney on Broadway, which you did at Paper Mill. I
Yeah.
mean, that's not exactly an easy connection to make. And their legal department's pretty tough too, I might add.
Yeah, I mean, Jolly Holiday was a really exciting. I love that show. It's a holiday celebration, but it utilizes the canon of Disney music from all of the Disney Broadway shows. So it was just really, really fun. We had the best time doing that show.
What triggers you to say, I mean, so we've gone through so many, and there's other Loch Ness. I mean, we can go on and on with the shows, but when you wake up in the morning, do you sort of like, I want to write a comedy? I want, are you just, let me see where the bug bites me today and we're going.
Yeah, sometimes it really depends. There's all different ways projects come to me. Sometimes they are projects like Clue or Mystic Pizza, where a producer has acquired the rights to material and they're looking for a creative team to develop it. That's one way. Sometimes I just get an idea in the shower, walking the dog, or wherever, and I think, oh, I know what to do there. I'm going to write something like that. Sometimes friends or collaborators or people I love come to me with ideas, and that can spark something. There's all different ways that ideas come to me, and I just try to stay open and open-hearted to it and see where it takes me.
And can you tell us what is in the works? I mean, just in looking at things that you're doing, there's a lot of things that seem to be happening right now, but are you writing anything right now that we'll see soon? If you can talk about it.
Yeah, sure. Always. I'm always writing something. I think there's two projects that I'm really excited about right now. Well, more than two that I'm excited about, but two that have my focus for this summer. One is I'm writing a musical with Edie Brickell
Oh,
and her
wow.
band. So, we were put together
As
one
in
of her
Steve
co-
Martin, Edie Brickell.
Yeah, exactly. But so one of her, the collaborators from Bright Star,
Yeah.
which is the musical she wrote with Steve Martin, is a collaborator of mine, and he sort of put us together, and the three of us are now developing a show together, and that's really exciting, and I've been enjoying that so much. And then the other one you just mentioned is this show about the Loch Ness Monster that I've been working on for the past year, and that's about to go into workshop and production moving forward, and that one is really
Is it going to
exciting
be
as
like
well.
the new Jaws franchise or something like that? Or
I don't know. I don't know, but I'm
Jurassic
excited
Park
about it.
could go in any direction.
Oh, it's not scary like that.
Okay. Is it a musical?
It's a musical. Yeah. Marshall Palit and A.D. Pinedo are the composer lyricist. And yeah, it's really been a pleasure to work on.
I am just, I mean, I have no right to be proud of you. What am I? I'm not your parent, but I'm just so amazed and proud. I'll just say it as like one of my Chicago colleagues here has done what
Thank
you've done. And I can't wait to see what comes next. I am available for voiceover work if you need me.
Okay,
If
good
you're
to
willing
know.
to,
Well, thank you.
yeah, if you're willing to train me, I think it's been great. Sandy Rustin, congratulations on all that you do. You have the dream career. There's a lot of people watching this who went, I want to be her. I kind of want to be you too.
Oh my gosh, that's so kind of you. Thank you. And it means so much to me to just be able to have an interview on WGN, my hometown network. So thank
I
you.
love it. And with my thanks to you and your mom, who's probably watching this, thanks to everybody who's watched us here at Paulus Behind the Curtain, and we'll see you next week.